funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Deborah Wong. Coming up, international aid workers in Iran move from rescuing quake victims to saving survivors from looming epidemics.
And a year after the SARS virus first appeared, where are we now in terms of fighting infectious disease?
If something much more contagious does emerge with the same level of surprise and unanticipated pathway of emergence as SARS had, we're just not ready.
Also, our D.C. roundtable on this year's big winners, George W. Bush and Howard Dean.
British pilots react angrily to a U.S. demand for armed marshals.
And a high school band readies for the Rose Bowl parade.
These stories and more, coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. The federal government is requiring that armed law enforcement officers be aboard international flights entering or leaving the U.S. if there's intelligence information that terrorists may be planning to use the aircraft as a weapon. NPR's Pam Fessler has more.
The new directive was issued in light of heightened concerns over the holidays about the possibility of terrorists hijacking airplanes. The Department of Homeland Security says international air carriers will be required to have armed government law enforcement officials on board if there's information indicating that a certain flight has been targeted. Thousands of armed air marshals already fly aboard overseas and international flights by U.S. air carriers, but many foreign carriers do not have armed marshals. The prospect of having some on board is already drawing criticism. The British Airline Pilots Association says it's concerned about the move and has advised members not to fly their planes if they're uncomfortable with having an armed official on board. Pam Fessler, NPR News, Washington.
A baby girl who was protected by her dead mother's arms was rescued alive from the rubble of the earthquake in Iran today. A 12-year-old girl was also rescued, but a 7-year-old boy who was found alive died before he could be dug out. More than 25,000 bodies have been recovered so far from the devastated city of Bam. The search resumes today for 2 children still missing after the mudslide that blanketed a church youth camp in Southern California on Christmas Day. 12 bodies from the camp have been recovered so far, as well as 2 from a private campground nearby. From member station KCRW, Eric Roy reports.
Authorities say hopes are pretty slim of finding more survivors. 4 days after a wall of mud buried a Greek Orthodox youth and adult camp in Waterman Canyon near San Bernardino, and another mudslide swept through a nearby KOA campground. Sunday, about 200 people gathered at the Church of God Prophecy in San Bernardino to mourn the deaths. About 24 church members spent Christmas at the Orthodox camp at the invitation of the caretaker. New storms expected tonight and tomorrow could drop another 4 inches of rain on Southern California. The San Bernardino County Sheriff's Department says that could mean more mudslides in a 30-mile patch of mountainside left bare by this fall's wildfires. A Southern California flash flood watch extends as far north as San Luis Obispo. For NPR News, I'm Eric Roy in Los Angeles.
Hospitals in New Hampshire are being urged to be hypervigilant in looking for cases of bacterial meningitis after 5 teenagers were hospitalized with symptoms of the disease within the past week. One of the young people has died. Doctors in the state say it's unusual to see that many cases in a short period of time. The Agriculture Department is insisting there is no risk to consumers from meat recalled as a result of the first case of mad cow disease in this country. The meat was recalled as a precaution. The department says the single dairy cow that was infected was imported from Canada. Wall Street at this hour. The Dow Jones Industrial Average is now up 54 points at 10,378 in light trading. The Nasdaq Composite is up 17 at 1990. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, stocks have edged higher today as the market picks up some steam following last week's lull in trading. Wall Street historically has a modest rally in the last trading days of the year and the first 2 trading days in January. A measure of the strength of the U.S. labor market has posted its first increase since the summer. The Conference Board, a New York-based business research group, says its Help Wanted Index was up 2 points last month. NPR's Jack Spear has more.
In a week with only a few other economic indicators due out, financial markets may focus a bit more than usual on the Conference Board's Help Wanted Index. The index, which looks at the volume of Help Wanted advertising in 51 newspapers across the country, showed a gain of 2 points in November. Overall, 7 of 9 regions surveyed showed a rise in Help Wanted advertising. Looked at another way, there was an increase in the level of help wanted ads in 73% of the labor market surveyed. The strongest gains occurred in the New England region, which had an increase of more than 15.5%. It's the first rise in the help wanted index since June. The latest increase puts the index just a point below its level of a year ago. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
Shares of burger giant McDonald's are up somewhat today after the stock was upgraded by J.P. Morgan. An analyst there expects only slight consumer reaction to mad cow concerns beyond the immediate term, assuming discovery of future cases is limited. Pennsylvania's Community and Economic Development Secretary has announced today that he's declaring the city of Pittsburgh to be financially distressed. That designation opens the way for a state-appointed coordinator to formulate a recovery plan for the city. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Annie E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Deborah Wong, in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Iran's supreme religious leader vowed today to rebuild Bam, the ancient Iranian city leveled by last week's earthquake. Some rescue teams have now called off the search for survivors in Bam and have turned their attention to tending the thousands made homeless by the quake and burying the victims, whose number could reach 40,000. Joining us on the line from Tehran is reporter Shirzad Bezorgmehr. Welcome, Shirzad.
Thank you.
Are there any survivors today?
I've heard only about one that was late last night. And let me correct that, because I just saw a few minutes ago on Iranian television that a man was pulled from the rubble and he was alive.
Oh. Well, this morning in Bam marked 72 hours after the earthquake, and rescue experts say that 72 hours is about as long as anyone can survive under rubble. So what is the thinking there about more survivors?
It's a little bit pessimistic now, regarding the issue of survivors. Somehow the focus of the rescue is now shifting from possible survivors to those who have actually been made homeless, lost loved ones, and have nowhere to go. Mass burials continue. The latest estimate we've had of the dead is anywhere between 18,000 to 25,000. It's very hard to come to a very correct figure so soon. It takes time. Basically, this is where it stands right now.
Well, that would leave at least 60,000 people homeless and in frigid temperatures. What are some of the other problems facing the people in the area?
The urgent needs that they have right now are electricity generators, kerosene, blankets, tents, you know, the basic materials needed under these circumstances. The reports that we're getting here is that the government and foreign agencies are making a difference. But as the President Khatami said, whatever you do under these circumstances, it will not be enough, and there will be people who will not get help enough and at the time when they need it.
I understand there's been a surge in looting and a fear of an outbreak of epidemics, so a distribution of face masks, because it must just be horrendous.
There is obviously, in conditions like this, fear of epidemics, but the mask that you refer to and you see on television is mostly because of the stench that people who are very close to the bodies, working with the bodies, have to wear it. I am not aware of any actual epidemics reports so far.
Shirzad, what's been the reaction, even where you are in Tehran, to four American cargo planes arriving with aid and landing on Iranian soil?
The reaction of the people who are working with those Americans have been very positive. The Iranian army personnel and Red Crescent people and all who came in contact with the Americans greeted them warmly, naturally, because of the help that they're bringing. But this question of politicizing it has not come up so much, not in Iran anyway, even if there is some feeling that it could become political, because of the immensity of the disaster right now, they're not really thinking about it in political terms, actually.
I know that Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran, visited BAM today and pledged that the city would be rebuilt. Is it possible, really, to rebuild, for instance, the citadel there, which was considered the world's largest surviving mud fortress, which is now, as someone said, it's like a crumbled sandcastle, a 2,000-year-old fortress. Is it possible to rebuild this?
Well, the city that we're talking about is the old city of BAM. It's different from the citadel that you're talking about. The citadel is destroyed, but the Italians are saying that they are willing to foot the bill for rebuilding the old citadel of BAM, but they're saying that we're going to make some research and see that if it is practical to do it, we will do it for Iran. Right.
But first, the city must bury its dead. Shirzad, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Shirzad Bozorghmir, Deputy Editor-in-Chief of Iran News, speaking to us from Tehran.
Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon has ordered the evacuation of four settlement outposts in the West Bank, one of the provisions in the U.S.-backed Middle East peace plan. But settlers vow resistance, saying they'll clash with soldiers. Meantime, the Israeli military is being criticized for shooting and seriously wounding a protester over the weekend. Not an uncommon occurrence in Israel, but this time the victim was Israeli, and there are now questions about why lethal force was used. To get a closer look at what's happening in Israel, we turn to Washington Post correspondent Molly Moore, who joins us from Jerusalem. Molly, welcome.
Thank you very much.
First of all, tell us the circumstances of this shooting. What happened?
Well, there were a group of protesters who had gathered at one of the points where this large barrier complex is being built. What the Israeli military says is that the protesters started trying to cut through a gate in this section of the fence, which was in the central part of the West Bank. And soldiers who had been interviewed by the Israeli media said, you know, that they thought it was Palestinians trying to tear down the fence, and they opened fire. It's not unusual at all for the Israeli military to open fire that they see on people that they see near this barrier line or near any of the fence or barrier lines that separate some of the Palestinian territories from Israel. What is different in this case is that they hit an Israeli. It was, in fact, not just any Israeli. It was a soldier who had just finished his active duty combat service in an Israeli military combat unit just a month ago.
And this has touched off something of a national debate about how the army deals with protesters?
Prime Minister Ariel Sharon yesterday at the cabinet meeting took the rather unusual step of saying that there needs to be an investigation. It appeared to him that this is the kind of result that should not happen from military activities. The military chief of staff, in fact, visited him in the hospital over the weekend.
Do you think that it's likely to change, for example, the Army's rules of engagement with protesters?
That's very much yet to be seen. The military has called for an investigation. Now, when Palestinians are hit in situations like this, usually the investigations find no fault with the soldiers. It's only in very rare cases that the military is held at fault. So the question that will remain here is, once the international complaints and the domestic complaints are over, how far the military will take this. And that will determine whether or not the military will actually take any significant action and change its tactics.
Now, the Prime Minister is moving forward on plans to disengage Israel from the Palestinians if the peace effort fails. What's the latest?
Well, the latest is there was an announcement this weekend that the Prime Minister had signed an order removing four illegal outposts, only one of which is actually occupied by people. There are maybe about 10 families on this one small outpost. So what the Prime Minister is saying now is not really any different from what he's been saying for the last year. And generally what happens is they'll go in, remove the trailer, and it'll be set up somewhere on the next hillside or a few hundred yards away. So there's not been a whole lot of specific activity taken one way or other on the disengagement.
Is it expected that at some point we will see confrontations and you'll have the prospect of the Israeli army having to move against these settlers?
Well, it already has. Every time there's even an action against one of these small outposts, what happens is every young settler for miles around gathers and in protest at this site, starts harassing the soldiers, shouting at them. It's very, very unpleasant for the soldiers, many of whom of these soldiers actually live in settlements in the Palestinian territories themselves. Now, these classes thus far have never involved lethal force. In fact, the soldiers who go out and do this dismantling don't even carry weapons. And so the military tries very, very hard not to let these situations escalate.
Molly, thanks for joining us.
You're quite welcome.
Molly Moore is a correspondent for The Washington Post.
The U.S. Department of Homeland Security announced this morning that it will require armed guards on some incoming international flights. The announcement comes less than a week after six Air France flights were canceled amid U.S. intelligence fears that terrorists might use commercial airliners as weapons, as they did on September 11th. Today's directive affects cargo planes and passenger aircraft. Although it's not clear how many of the thousands of daily international flights will be affected or whether they will comply. In Britain, airline pilots have threatened to block the use of armed marshals. For more, we turn to Chris Yates, security editor with the British publication Jane's Aviation. Welcome, Chris.
Thank you.
Well, so how are international air carriers reacting to the new rules from the Homeland Security Department?
With some degree of anger, I probably would suggest to you, certainly the British Airline Pilots Association has a negative response to using sky marshals, particularly armed sky marshals, on board aircraft operating out of this country for many reasons, including the safety of passengers and aircrew.
But what about British political officials? I mean, we're reading that the Commissioner of the Metropolitan Police spoke of a huge leap in terrorist activity, and they might override the concerns of the pilots.
That's indeed a possibility, but it has to be said that perhaps that intelligence is not being used to the best advantage. And it's certainly been the case in the United States, where you bounced from yellow to orange alert alarmingly regularly, and nothing has happened. And that would suggest that what the authorities are doing is using the first piece of intelligence that comes in.
Well, as you said, nothing has happened, and we don't know if nothing has happened because of the intelligence and because of the reaction to the intelligence, no?
That's a very good point, but it seems likely, given all of the evidence that we eventually see, that perhaps some of the intelligence coming in is actually flawed.
Well, do you think the carriers will even be able to comply with putting armed guards on flights if they get a call, you know, saying we have a terrorist alert, do it by this afternoon? I mean, in other words, how able are they to even comply?
Certainly most countries in Europe have the capability to field sky marshals as and when they're required. You know, we're not talking about putting sky marshals on every single flight. We're talking about putting sky marshals on selected flights that some of this intelligence would suggest are at some degree of risk.
Right. What is your personal opinion about sky marshals?
I have some degree of concern about the use of sky marshals on board aircraft. The minute you introduce someone who is armed on board a commercial passenger plane, then you also increase the risk to the safety of the passengers on board that aircraft. Let's not forget that what we saw on September the 11th, I would suggest to you, was an aberration. The received wisdom prior to September the 11th had always been that if anybody seized an airliner, then you would negotiate with the people who seized the airliner. It doesn't follow that every single hijacker or terrorist is a member of Al-Qaeda, and therefore it doesn't follow that this is a suicide mission. I will prefer to be safe on board that aeroplane and the knowledge that these people are being negotiated with than being in the crossfire between a terrorist and a sky marshal.
Chris Yates, thank you.
Thank you.
Chris is security editor with the British publication Jane's Aviation. He spoke to us from Birmingham, England.
Just ahead, SARS may be making a comeback in China. Is the world health community ready for another outbreak?
And later in the program, preparing for a performance that 325 million people will watch.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
China is actively cooperating with the World Health Organization in its investigation of the first suspected case of the SARS virus in that country since July. China had previously come under criticism for its slow reporting and lack of cooperation at the height of the SARS crisis. Health officials this weekend reported that a television producer in the southern city of Guangzhou may have the disease. 81 people who came in contact with the patient have been quarantined. Nearly 8,000 people fell ill with SARS last year, most of them in Asia, and more than 700 people died. Lori Garrett is the Newsday reporter who covered the outbreak. She's the author of The Coming Plague and Betrayal of Trust. Recently, we checked in with her to see how much progress has been made in understanding the disease.
Well, we certainly know more, but we still have enormous gaps in understanding of the really vital issues of transmission and how you control the spread of the virus.
It didn't end up being as bad as we had feared, though. At the time, there were worries this could be the next pandemic. That didn't happen.
Well, we dodged a bullet, partly because the World Health Organization response and the responses of key nations, not including China, were swift and reasonably wise. But it did end up, the best estimate is, costing the global economy $30 billion. And the price tag, in some senses, is still being tallied because, well, mainland China's economy bounced back swiftly, and mainland China, in the end for 2003, is still showing dramatic GDP growth. Hong Kong, Taiwan, Singapore continue to suffer, and tourism remains down for that region. As far as the virus itself goes and the possibility of return and of a kind of larger scale epidemic, I think the first thing I have to say is nobody really thought SARS was going to be akin to 1918 flu. From the very beginning, I think there was a clear understanding that this virus, for whatever lucky reason, didn't appear to be as contagious as influenza. I think the real big shocker take-home message for the Asian governments and for Canada has been, wow, you know, we're not ready. And if something much more contagious does emerge with the same level of surprise and unanticipated pathway of emergence as SARS had, we're just not ready.
Now, there is this concern that the virus or something like it, as you say, might reemerge. How does this work? I mean, where does a virus go when it doesn't have a host?
Well, first of all, we don't know what the host for this virus is. That's the key point. There's a lot of evidence pointing to two or three key food markets in Guangdong province that sell exotic live animals for consumption by human beings. And these markets have so many species that narrowing it down and being very clear which species was carrying it is very difficult. There's a lot of reason to believe it's what are called the mast palm civets, But there are other species in these markets that have tested positive. Now, the problem is we're still not absolutely sure which animals in the markets were infected and gave the virus to the Homo sapiens that were working or buying in those markets. And then we have to work backwards from there. Where did the animals come from? Animals in these markets came from as far south as Sumatra and as far north as Siberia. So that's quite a geographic area for the World Health Organization and scientists from all over the world to scour to try and find the natural habitat of this virus.
If the suspicion is that these wildlife markets are the breeding ground for new viruses, has anything on the ground changed? Are these markets still in existence?
Yes, they are. The Chinese government initially denied any connection and released their own scientific studies that contradicted Hong Kong and independent studies, claiming that there were no infected animals in the markets. And then under pressure from the scientific community and World Health Organization, they backed off of that claim, and the animal trade is back up and full steam ahead as it was before.
Now, whatever happened in Asia, the U.S. was for the most part spared from this virus. Do you have a sense that if something like this were to happen again, U.S. hospitals, emergency rooms, would be prepared for something like it?
I don't know a single public health official or emergency room director who thinks that they are prepared.
What's the worst-case scenario?
Well, I think the worst-case scenario still is the emergence of a 1918 type of influenza. That remains the biggest concern. And the fact that we're having so much trouble coming up with an appropriate number of doses of vaccine and finding the correct formulary for the vaccine illustrates just how vulnerable we are, even though we are far more high-tech and so on than we were in 1918. All we have to do is look at what happened in Toronto. Canada has a very sophisticated medical and public health system, and yet they had an incredibly difficult time bringing SARS under control in Toronto. And the vast majority of cases were spread within the medical settings themselves. I think we would have a very similar set of problems here in the United States, in large part because we, like Toronto, are very dependent on high-tech medicine. We tend to put patients, once they're hospitalized, on a lot of equipment. And every piece of equipment that goes into a patient or is attached to the patient's body in some way is a potential site of contamination. What we find with SARS is that this was a virus that very effectively exploited this sort of high-tech medical environment. And if you add to that another layer, which is rushed, overworked nursing staff, we have nurses that are trying to handle too many patients for shifts that are too long. They're exhausted, they're harried, they can't keep track, and in that context, they tend to make mistakes and get sloppy about infection control.
Laurie, thanks very much.
Okay.
Laurie Garrett is a reporter with Newsday. Her books, The Coming Plague and Betrayal of Trust, examine infectious disease. She joined us from New York.
As always, we welcome your thoughts on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave us a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we'll have all the news and Discovery Magazine's top science stories of the year.
Also, the resurgence of puppets, from the Muppets to the Broadway stars of Avenue Q to Triumph, the foul-mouthed dog.
Oh, boy. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. Thank you.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, our editorial roundtable takes a look at the year past and ahead at the man who seems to get all the press coverage today, Howard Dean.
And members of a New Hampshire high school marching band prepare for their debut in the upcoming Tournament of Roses parade with some pretty tricky moves.
Flipping the sousaphones off our bodies and then rotating them and spinning them around and stuff.
Have you ever done that before?
I just figured it out today, as a matter of fact.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. In Iran today, rescuers found a 12-year-old girl alive in the rubble of her family's house, even as some searchers called off their efforts to find anyone else alive. Reporter Akbar Dharani says the city of Bam has been hit by more strong aftershocks, but people did not seem to panic.
There were two big aftershocks jolting the city of Bam. The first time I was just standing over the main wall of the Bam Citadel. It was so strong that everything jolted. Several bricks fall down and I was about to fall. People really frightened. They had nothing more to lose because there's no standing buildings.
Also today, Iran's supreme leader visited Bam and pledged to rebuild it. More than 25,000 bodies have been recovered since Friday's 6.6 magnitude earthquake. U.S. soldiers continue to come under fire in Iraq. Rebels lobbed a grenade and fired on U.S. soldiers searching homes for insurgents in the northern city of Mosul, triggering a firefight that left three Iraqis dead and two U.S. soldiers wounded. The gun battle came a day after roadside bombs killed two U.S. soldiers and two Iraqi children in central Iraq. United Nations weapons inspectors have determined that Libya was in the early stages of developing a nuclear weapons technology program before it voluntarily dismantled its efforts. Mohamed El-Baradi and a team from the International Atomic Energy Agency found the equipment had been taken apart and boxed up. The UN team says that while Libya's program was years away from a nuclear weapon, it was far more advanced than had been expected. In New Hampshire, where five teenagers have been hospitalized with bacterial meningitis, including one who died, health officials are urging hospitals to be even more alert, to be hypervigilant in recognizing cases of the disease. Meningitis can cause the brain to swell, and its symptoms can appear similar to the flu. But with meningitis, up to 15% of the cases are fatal. The chief veterinarian for the U.S. Department of Agriculture says there are no plans to expand a beef recall. Eight states in the U.S. territory of Guam are scrambling to find several tons of meat that may have been processed along with a cow infected with mad cow disease. Dr. Rhonda Haven says officials still don't believe there is a risk to consumers, that the recalls are precautionary.
We'll be right back.
I'm Deborah Wong, in for Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Doesn't it feel as if U.S. forces have been in Iraq forever? But it's only been since March. 2003 began with a war already in progress in Afghanistan and ends with a war that refuses to quit in Iraq as the U.S. heads into 2004, a presidential election year. Our D.C. roundtable is here with a look back at the year that was, from President Bush's State of the Union claim that Iraq was getting uranium from Africa to Howard Dean's comments, hey, let's not judge Osama bin Laden until he's had a trial. And all with the Iowa caucus, just look at that, 3 weeks away. Joining us on the line are David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Hi, David.
Hi, Robin.
And Sarah Fritz, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Robin.
Sarah, let's start with you first. Your thoughts on the year that was, the winners and losers.
Winners and losers. Well, I'd say that George Bush ended up the year as a winner after the discovery of Saddam Hussein. But he had a tough year, and it shows the kind of year that he may have again if things don't progress as they're expected to in Iraq, and if the economy doesn't add some jobs. I think he could have a tough year again in the election year.
David, some would say President Bush is a huge winner this past year.
Oh, I think he's a big winner of the year, and so is Howard Dean, who expected to be coming into caucuses and primaries as an insurgent, instead comes in as the front runner. It's an astonishing development. I can think of no precedent, and it's a remarkable achievement for him. So I think Dean and Bush are the winners of the year, and the big loser of the year, of course, is Saddam Hussein.
Well, there's that. But sticking with Dean for a second, it's amazing to be sort of out of the news swim for a week on holiday. Come back. I cannot believe how much press coverage he's getting. Sarah, are you guys salivating over him with the comments that he's recently made?
Well, I think everyone's a little bit confused about what he represents. Inside the Beltway here, you hear that he's the liberal Democratic candidate, and yet the way he governed in Vermont, he doesn't look like much of a liberal. And I mean, I don't think anybody quite understands what he means for the Democratic Party.
Well, David, I'm thinking of some of recent Dean comments. He took a swipe at Terry McAuliffe, the Democratic Party chairman, saying that the party lacks strong leadership, you know, sort of get the other candidates off my back. Last week he said that the Democratic Leadership Council represents the Republican wing of the Democratic Party, quite an insult. He's also had that comment about Osama bin Laden, you know, being innocent until proven guilty, even though Osama bin Laden's already said he's guilty. How are you playing the comments?
Well, I think in a way you can think of Howard Dean as a jobs program for political correspondents. No matter what happens, he always has some remark to make that's going to be interesting, that's fodder for further commentary. And he's the most unpredictable potential nominee of a major party, I think, since Barry Goldwater. And for that reason, maybe the most interesting.
Robin, I would argue that that's a virtue. After covering, as a reporter, covering such programmed candidates for so long, it's something of a breath of fresh air to talk to someone who actually, thinks on his feet and maybe says the wrong thing now and then. But political speak has become so programmed that I find it enjoyable to talk to someone who's likely to say something new.
It's very refreshing, but it's also very dangerous.
Right.
Well, I was going to say the Republicans are enjoying Howard Dean as much as the Democrats and the press seem to be. But Dean is part of the future. He's part of the next year. Let's continue to take a look back, though, at the past. If you would, David, just highlight for me some of the moments of the past year. I'm thinking of one that seems to have completely disappeared. Whatever happened to Valerie Plame, the outed CIA agent, and her husband, Joseph Wilson, the one who was sent to Africa to investigate the African Al-Qaeda connection? These are people that were so hot on the radar, and then they're just gone.
Well, they've become transformed from major people to bit players in Trivial Pursuit. I don't think anybody thinks that they'll be major players in 2004. Some of the highlights, though, of the last year, of course, have been the ups and downs and ultimately the up of the stock market, up about 35% by some measures. And then also the uncertainty that the Dean nomination has thrown the Democratic Party into, almost no Democratic Party heavies, with the possible exception of Al Gore, think he's the right man. And so they're in trouble in some ways.
It keeps coming back to Howard Dean, doesn't it, Sarah?
Yes, I guess so.
Congress, let's just take a quick look there. David, they can crow that there was a Medicare bill passed. There are detractors who say it's not a very good bill, but they seem to have lost the public relations campaign.
They have, and there's not much glory to have been reaped on Capitol Hill this year, and no one will reap much of it. Some folks might be reelected, but they sure won't be reelected with enthusiasm.
Well, I think a measure of how poorly Congress has done is when you look through the United States and see how state legislatures are currently handling many of the issues, including medical and health care issues, that Congress was expected to deal with.
But, Sarah, aren't we going to be seeing a lot of ads in the coming campaign season crowing about having passed a Medicare bill?
Oh, no question about it. It's not until 2006 when the benefit begins and people begin to experience what a dismal benefit it is, that it's going to be a disappointment.
Well, there was no energy bill passed, and that reminds me, what about that big East Coast blackout this summer? Who's going to be the big winner or loser because of that?
Well, I think that, it's quite possible that we, the taxpayers, will be the losers.
But politically?
Politically, I think those kinds of things hurt the sitting president, the sitting members of Congress, when things don't go right.
They undermine public confidence in the way things are supposed to be, and they undermine people's sense of assurance, as do our terrorism alerts, that things are getting better, that progress is being made technologically, militarily, culturally in the country, and I think that never redounds to the benefit of the party that's in power.
Well, and, David,
and I would say, Robin, that 2003 was a year in which the public was extremely anxious about whether things were going to work and whether we were going to be safe.
And the year ends that exact same way, don't you think, Sarah?
Yes.
People worried about things, checking the news all the time.
And that hurts incumbent politicians everywhere.
Because this is a nation that not only is not at peace in the world, but not at peace with itself. And I think that's ultimately a very dangerous thing. No country can live for a long period of time that way. The president may reap the short-term benefits of it, but it's a challenge for him.
Yes.
And I think Sarah's hit a very important point, is that the president is in fully control of his own destiny. His destiny is controlled by Wall Street. It's controlled by Osama bin Laden. It's controlled by people we don't even know in Iraq and in other places and other threats we haven't even thought about. That's a dangerous place for a politician to be, and an extremely uncomfortable one. And I think President Bush should be the first to tell you that he'd want to be in control of his own destiny rather than have his destiny be in response to other people's actions.
I'm sure of that.
Well, I want to thank you both.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Sarah Fritz, Washington Bureau Chief of the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. David Shribman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette.
And still to come, musicians from a New Hampshire high school prepare to make their television debut before hundreds of millions of people at the Tournament of Roses Parade.
You're listening to Here and Now.
Leavenworth, Washington is about as far away from Bavaria in Germany as you can get in the United States. But this Christmas time, you wouldn't know it. Annually, the town transforms itself into a Christmas winter wonderland, Bavarian style. Joining us on the line is Ken Conehurst, Media Relations Director for the town. Welcome, Ken.
Oh, thank you very much, Deborah. It's great to be on your program.
Well, thank you. First of all, how authentic is this Bavarian Christmas celebration of yours?
Well, the folks here in Leavenworth, we think it's probably the closest you can get to Germany without the passport.
What exactly does a Bavarian Christmas entail?
Well, a couple of things, Deborah, is we have a traditional German market, which is modeled after those open-air markets that you would find in Germany that have been all around for hundreds and hundreds of years. So people can come and get the sights and the smells and the sounds of Christmas already. Things like Glühwein or roasted almonds and bratwurst and enjoy Christmas music.
Now, not only do you celebrate the rituals of a Bavarian Christmas, but you've gone whole hog, essentially. You've created actually a town that looks like a Bavarian village. Can you describe it?
Well, the best way I can describe it to you is that it reminds me of being in a little Bavarian village, and you cannot build a building in Leavenworth without it being approved, and so that it has the Bavarian feel.
The Pacific Northwest is about as far from Germany as you can get in the United States. So how is it that this town came to look like it does?
Well, the town was pretty dependent on logging and mining through the years, and what had happened is logging industry left the area, as did the mining. And so in the early 60s, Leavenworth was pretty much a depressed town, and we had buildings that were literally boarded up. One day, someone came upon the idea. They said, you know, I've got this postcard here of Germany, and boy, this sure looks like a little... We could look just like this where we're located here in the mountains and everything else. And that was kind of the spark that started everything, and then the transformation took place.
Did this seem a little bit wacky at the time, to just reinvent yourself?
I think so.
Aside from just having a photograph on a postcard, did anyone have a clue what a Bavarian town was all about?
Not really. In fact, a couple of the townspeople made a trip to Solvang, California, which some of your listeners probably have heard of, and they're a Dutch community that is a theme town, and so that gave them some ideas which way to go, and then they found a German architect, and he started drawing up some plans for the different buildings and how they could transform those into German-style-looking buildings, and one by one, that was done.
I've been to Leavenworth, and it's gorgeous, but I must say it's a little odd that you're driving along and suddenly you feel like you've stumbled onto a movie set.
That's very true, very true. And, you know, I can wear my lederhosen here, and my wife can wear her dirndl, and we can go down the streets on Sunday and have a wonderful time and talk to the tourists that come here and quite frankly, not feel out of place.
So you really wear your lederhosen in public?
Absolutely.
Ah. Ken, thanks very much.
Okay.
Ken Conehurst is Media Relations Director for the town of Leavenworth, Washington.
Stay with us. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
It's Here and Now.
This New Year's Day, more than 200 high school musicians from Londonderry, New Hampshire, will put on their plumed hats, pick up their sousaphones, saxophones, and piccolos, and march in the 115th Tournament of Roses Parade in Pasadena, California. The Londonderry Lancers will be one of 23 bands from around the world appearing in the mother of all American parades. It's the Lancers' third trip to the Rose Parade, but this year's band is new at it. And in front of a worldwide television audience, they have some tricky maneuvers to make. At a rehearsal last week, Here and Now's Lynn Menegon spoke with Andy Soucy, music and band director at Londonderry High School, about how 480 feet will march together without getting blisters.
We have 46 piccolos, we have 38 trumpets, 18 trombones, 9 sousaphones, a bass drum line, 9 snare drums. We have a clarinet line of 45, I believe, somewhere around there, saxophones. It's a good-sized band. We march the kids 9 across, and to watch them from the banner to the last person, it's about almost 90 yards. It almost takes the length of a football field. There are only 12 bands, high school, selected from outside of California in the country. So it's a pretty unique, probably a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. It's not very common to see a band show up three times. One of the things we focus on is showmanship. And we have a lot of kids, and we cover the street, and we play a lot of music. That is a 5.5-mile parade, 2.5 hours long. We will play nonstop, really. And by the way, there are a million people on the streets, physically on the streets, in that 5.5 miles. And, you know, that's a lot of people to play for in one sitting. Our goal is that no one drops out. And and I'm pretty convinced that that's what's going to happen. No one's going to drop out. They're going to be on such an adrenaline high. It's painful. At the end of the parade, there will be kids in pain, a great deal of pain. The last time we had a student who was a cancer survivor as a child who only had one lung, he made the whole parade. And I know that was adrenaline. And we had another student that had a fever of 102. He marched the whole thing. You get so worked up inside that no matter what it takes to accomplish this, you just do it.
Please wear band-aids during the parades. Please. One girl had to drop out of a parade when I was marching in New York because she had blisters on the back of her feet and they were both bleeding really bad. And I don't blame her for doing that, but she should have been wearing band-aids.
I'm Jackie Topper, and I'm the color guard captain for the Lancers. We do spin flags, and we're marching behind the band, and we're just basically their visual accompaniment, I guess.
So you don't march in front of them? Is the color guard always in the rear of the band?
Not always, but for Roses, because they shoot down the boulevard, you can see the flags behind the band. It works out really well.
The most difficult part of this parade is this 105-degree turn that they have at TV Corner, and that's where all the cameras are, and the Goodyear blimp, and all these news helicopters are up there shooting down on a parade, and it's very, very impressive and very intimidating because the worldwide audience is 325 million, and I can't imagine that. Some kids will probably get a little nervous, and that's okay because, there's nobody else around us. You know, we'll just do what it takes to get beyond the turn. We've done it twice before, and I feel very confident that they're going to do it again. And every other band has to do the same thing, so.
You need to try this on for me. You need to try on the pants so that we can see if they're the right pants.
We actually just got all of the band uniforms dry cleaned, which is about 220 or 230.
Oh my God, do you like take over the dry cleaner?
Absolutely. For the past 2 weeks, we've actually taken over the dry cleaner.
Is it too tight?
No.
Okay.
My name is Sherry Kurtzman, and I am one of the 3 drum majors of the Lancer Marching Band.
What's a drum major?
We command the band. We stand in front. We conduct in front of the band.
How do you command a band?
To command a band, you have to... It's a good question. To command a band, you really have to know the people in the band. You have to somehow get the attention of all of the members and keep their attention, which is the hardest part. And absolutely, always, your eyes are with pride.
But there's 250 people behind you. They can't see your eyes.
It doesn't matter if they can. People around you, the audience can see you. Knowing that I'm representing such a great band, that just makes me keep going.
Detail, halt! Detail to the ready!
As a drum major, I wear a headphone to listen to the director telling us what to do to make sure that the band doesn't fall apart as we're marching. With the number of whistles, we'll call song 2, and we'll all blow 2 whistles, and the band will know that's the next song after the roll-off.
What's a roll-off?
A roll-off is how the drummers come from a street beat, which is what we march to regularly, which just has a good beat. That's how they get from the street beat to the actual song that we play.
So a roll-off is like a little tattoo of drums or something?
Exactly.
come on. Detail. I say, hut. Detail to the ready. Jill, get it together, will you please? Detail. I say, hut. That looks pretty casual for attention. Detail to the ready. Detail. I say, hut. No snap.
There are times where he'll yell and he'll scream, but you know deep down he's really just proud of the band.
Do it again.
You got to correct them, and you have to correct them with a sense of urgency. You know, but yet you don't want to make them panic, because if they panic, then you've lost them. You have to teach them how to believe in themselves. Okay. Now with the yelling, I saw improvement.
This is the exercise. Just going to make turns. Forward, heart. People on the outside need to take a bigger step. Go back, reset, please. Reset.
Can I talk to you for a second? Quick second?
Yeah.
What's your name?
Stephen Morse.
And what instrument do you play?
I play snare drum.
So now everybody's marched around in the circle and totally screwed up. I'm very tense. Are you tense? Are you nervous?
Yeah, but I know that we're going to be prepared for this. It's going to be fun, so.
People on the outside have to move. You got to start your turn quicker. Otherwise, we'll be there for way too long. Do that again.
Ready now.
Okay, go. Good job. Don't turn.
We were planning a move to do a visual in the parade, flipping the sousaphones off our bodies and then rotating them and spinning them around and stuff.
Tell me your name.
Anthony Grizzlack.
Have you ever done that before?
I just figured it out today, as a matter of fact, so.
Have you all rehearsed this?
Not at all.
How many sousaphones do you have here?
We have 8 here tonight.
Conceivably, these are like 4-foot-high instruments. You could, like, hit each other.
It's possible. We'll probably work some way to separate and make it possible.
Keep half-stepping. Don't talk right now, you guys.
So you think they're ready?
Oh, yeah, I feel very confident. They will do a nice job, absolutely, because tonight is very important for them. They have to go through this. They have to, you know, we have to challenge them a little bit, and they'll have this feeling for the rest of their lives. But the feeling of accomplishment at the end of this parade is immeasurable. It's just the greatest. It's a relief. It's a feeling of fulfillment. It's just the greatest experience, and I know that feeling, and they're going to experience that at the end of the parade. And that's when they're going to look back and say, it was all worth it.
The Londonderry Lancers will march in the Rose Parade on New Year's Day. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Deborah Wong.
I'm Robin Young.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Deborah Wong.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
We'll hear Discover Magazine's top science stories of the year.
Also, puppets from the Broadway stars of Avenue Q to Triumph the Foul-Mouthed Dog.
That's Public Radio's midday news magazine, Here and Now.